Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Hacia, whose Executive Fellows Program provides Black and Latinx business owners with real-world tools and strategies needed to master fundamental management concepts related to company stability and growth. Registrants learn through one-on-one executive coaching sessions with subject matter experts in the areas of finance, business development, operations, and legal. More info at haciaworks.org.
From WBEZ Chicago, this is Nerdette. I'm Greta Johnson. We did it. We made it to another weekend. Coming up, comedian Aparna Nancherla talks about her new memoir, Unreliable Narrator, which is about imposter syndrome, among many other things.
Look, my navel is a portal to your navel. You know, like everyone loves to find out more about themselves.
But first, it is our chance to sit back and relax from the week that was with two excellent humans. With us this week is the host of the podcasts In the Cards and Dead Eyes, Connor Ratliff. Connor, hello.
Hello.
Also here is Bridget Todd, the host of CityCast DC and There Are No Girls on the Internet. Bridget, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back. I'm so thrilled to be back here again.
Yay. Okay, so let's start with this Barbie situation. Mattel, of course, lots of marketing this year, including a whole ass movie. Their latest release is a Stevie Nicks Barbie. It's part of a series of musicians, including Tina Turner and David Bowie. Y'all, I am tired. What do you think of this? Is there anyone who you'd be actually excited to see in Barbie form? Connor, what do you think about this situation?
Well, when I heard this, the first thing I thought of was back during the year that Thriller came out, I got a Michael Jackson doll that was basically, it wasn't Mattel, but it was basically the same size and scale as a Barbie doll. Uh-huh. And then when I got a little bit older, that became a hand-me-down to my sister, and Michael Jackson just became part of her Barbie world with all the other Barbie characters. So it does. I like the idea of expanding the Barbie verse to include notable musicians.
That's very true. I do feel a little conflicted about like the Michael Jackson of it, although I do have to say.
I mean, it's complicated, but it's a complicated world. And that's one of the things that the Barbie movie so eloquently unpacks is that there are no easy answers.
How beautifully put, Connor. What do you think, Bridget?
I mean, I'm with Connor here. I love to see an expanding Barbie universe, if you will. I actually badly wanted to buy the, when they made the doll of the director Ava DuVernay, I was like, I have to have that. I grew up in a Barbie house. My mom collected Barbies. I love Stevie Nicks. The one thing I will say about this Barbie doll is that when I saw a picture of it, I wouldn't have clocked it as a Stevie Nicks Barbie. I'm curious what y'all think, but I don't know. I love Stevie Nicks. I love Fleetwood Mac. I think she has an ethereal, witchy, delightfully messy witchy quality about her. And I don't feel like a Barbie doll can adequately represent that.
That's fair. I mean, I do think, the clothes she's wearing are essentially from the Rumors album cover.
She's got the bell sleeves. You know, I wouldn't mind seeing a Tusk era Stevie Nicks Barbie doll if we're getting into the albums and the eras.
Yeah, I like the idea of there being a great many Stevie Nicks Barbie variants to the point where your whole collection could just be Stevie Nicks.
There's just like dozens of Stevie Nickses.
Yeah.
I do kind of love that. It seems like she'd be pretty stoked about that too, oddly enough. Okay, so the next story I want to talk about is horrific. It's about bed bugs in Paris. The NPR story about this used the phrase blood sucking bed bugs, which like I just don't need in my life. They are all over France, including public transit. They're at the airport. Officials are calling this a public health issue. Of course, also Paris Fashion Week just wrapped up. So the cut is predicting some French bed bugs in New York. Connor, you're in New York. How do you feel?
I mean, I fortunately knock wood and hope that the wood isn't already infested with bedbugs. I really hope that New York doesn't have a new wave of bedbugs. Anyone that I know who's ever been infested is still traumatized by it, you know? I once went on a tour with a friend of mine, Don Finelli. We were going on an improv tour and we were sharing a hotel room and he had just been going through the whole bedbug thing. This was many years ago. And he was so paranoid about every surface, everywhere he went. You know, we got into the room, he immediately put all of his luggage in the bathtub and it was just like he'd been driven to distraction by it. So I know I would not handle it well. I hope that they're wrong. I hope that that is not what Fashion Week main trend is this year.
It just sounds so awful. Aparna, actually, in her book, she talks about how there was a period of her life when there were fleas in her house. And even she described it as feeling gaslit, partly because, you know, that feeling of like, wait, is that an itch? Like, I feel like itchiness more than almost anything else is like your brain can just become so hyperfixated and paranoid about it. It's like, how do you ever live a normal life after that?
Yeah. This is where I have to, I mean, I don't even know if I should admit this. I have had bed bugs once before in my life.
Oh my God.
Everything y'all are saying, I can confirm. It drives you. It's almost like a psychological torment. You know, I had to have my place, I live in an apartment. I had to have my apartment like heat treated. It was, and yeah, I when I travel, the first thing I do is I check the bed. I would never have a fabric headboard. But at least, like, I will say this. I almost feel a bit lucky that I had them when I did. Because back in the day, if you had bed bugs, you basically had to, like, leave town in shame. At least we have treatments today. Like, but it used to be, like, 15 years ago, if you got bed bugs, it was like a social stigma and you had to be very ashamed.
Oh my God, that's really funny. Well, the thing about like this NPR article uses the phrase like insecticide resistant, which I find deeply alarming.
Oh God.
Right? I mean, that's a thing about these days that I guess would not be good. What was the heat treatment like? Because it is, part of me is like, oh yeah, no, if once you have, like, you just have to burn it all, you know?
Basically, yeah. So when I got bed bugs, they were like, you have two options for treatment. One is we come to your house and we soak everything in chemicals. Two is you leave your house for, I think, 48 hours and we heat your entire home to a heat that is like, I guess bed bugs were not supposed to be able to live. This was a couple years ago. So I don't know if maybe they're making bed bugs different and now they'd be just like chilling. They'd be having a nice tropical vacation when you came back. But it did work. And like, when I tell you, like, it changes you for months after, if like a tissue touched my leg, I'm like, bed bug, you know, it's like you can never relax again in your own home.
Oh my God. So you still would say you are not fully recovered. Is that a fair assessment?
That is fair. I mean, I still just like Connor's friend, when I still, you know, I still carry the legacy of that bed bug trauma. But something I do want to add to make sure to add in this conversation, having bed bugs does not mean that you're dirty. It does not mean that you're like, I think that like there is a stigma that like, oh, if you have bed bugs, you're dirty. They had them at like Bergdorf Goodman in New York, right? Like they can wind up in like really fancy places. They can be anywhere. No one is safe.
It could be a sign that you're very fancy.
Yes.
Well, especially, you know, you have Les Bed Bug Françaises. Yeah. I mean, how cool is that?
I wonder if French bed bugs are, you know, like more refined. They're judging what you wear. Mm-hmm. They're smoking cigarettes.
They don't shave their armpits for sure.
Yes.
Okay. So the last story I want to talk with y'all about is actually from a woman in the Chicago area who is 104 years old and she skydived this week. Skydove. I don't know. It makes her the oldest person to jump out of an airplane with a parachute. I don't think I would ever want to do this. Bridget, are you like slightly more inclined?
I'm a little inclined. I think when I really got up there, I think I'd be that person that can't make the jump and has to sadly fly back down without jumping. I think once I was really up there, I don't think I could actually make the jump.
Oh my gosh. So Connor, is there something that you have thought about? Like if you did make it to even 100, like is there a thing you would want to do to celebrate that wouldn't involve jumping out of an airplane?
Oh, I don't know. When I think about trying to be that old, I'm already so tired. I want to do something nice and relaxing, something peaceful.
Maybe sleep forever.
Yeah, I can't imagine that jumping out of an airplane would be any more pleasurable than like fighting an alligator. You know, just like, it just sounds horrible to me.
Yeah, I think it sounds really bad too. Bridget, do you have like a, when I hit this age, I'm going to do this thing for you?
I think if I make it to like 105, I might become like a fancy cat burglar. and start I feel like if you're that age, people are like rooting for you, you know? So maybe that's what I'll do.
Wow, that's delightful. But I feel like you need a little more mobility probably.
Well, nobody's going to suspect the old lady with the walker, you know?
Maybe for me, it'll just be like Molly. I've never done Molly. Maybe that's my chance.
Sounds great.
I think more older folks need to be experimenting with hallucinogens for sure.
Right? Well, I appreciate both of your support. Connor, Bridget, thank you both so much for coming on. This was too much fun.
Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Right after the break, we are going to talk to comedian Aparna Nancherla about her new book, Unreliable Narrator.
Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Our next guest is comedian, TV writer, actor, podcast host, and now author Aparna Nancherla. Her new book is called Unreliable Narrator. It is a deeply personal memoir that covers a lot of ground. It's about anxiety and depression and sex and social media and anger, especially female anger, especially marginalized female anger. It is also a well-reported examination of the systems, both visible and invisible, that impact all of us, whether we like it or not. And of course, it still manages to be funny. Aparna, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. What a nice intro. And when you said podcast host, I was like, wait, really? I have a podcast?
You
but
do.
Then I remember I just hosted a series.
I mean, that counts, right?
Yes, yes, of course.
So the framing of this book starts with the idea of imposter syndrome, which you define early on, and I think we should do the same. Can you tell us what it is and kind of how it has shaped your experiences?
Sure. For me, imposter syndrome, when I was researching the book, it came up to mean like a set of feelings that kind of encompass just feeling like a fraud around any success or achievement you've had, like just feeling like you don't deserve it. It was all a fluke or luck, and just having this persistent worry that other people are going to find out that you have no idea what you're doing and don't deserve any of the things that you have quote unquote gotten.
Mm. It's funny because at first glance, I would consider myself not someone who deals with that. But when I really think about it, like I do, you know, live event moderation now and then. And my biggest nightmare is the idea of sitting on a stage with someone and like not having prepped well enough and having them turn to me and be like, who the fuck do you think you are to be here asking me questions right now? Which like I'm pretty sure is exactly the bucket that you were talking about.
Well, it's funny because I learned in writing the book that if you suffer from like imposter like feelings, it probably means you are not an imposter, because actual imposters do not struggle with that. They're usually kind of, you know, drinking their own Kool-Aid, and that kind of is what sells the whole thing more. So the fact that you're worrying about it is probably a sign that you are qualified to be in whatever position you're in.
Beautiful. I'll take it. It's funny. I mean, and you talk about this briefly in the book too, but like, I can't not ask about the irony of having the audacity to be the person to write a whole ass book about imposter syndrome.
I know. And I even said in the book, like I wrote about it in the hopes that I would get to the bottom of mine and fix it. And I feel like in writing it, not only did I not fix it, but I, if anything, like gave myself doubt more of a platform internally, which is not the move I was hoping to make. But yeah, I think if anything, it has brought up the feeling of like, oh my God, you thought you could write a book about this? You fool. Like it's just only compounded some of the feelings, but you know, more to get out of therapy.
Well, also though, like you did write the book. I mean, how does it feel any different now that it's like out in the world and people are reading it?
Yeah, I think it feels, and maybe this is with any act of creation, not to make myself sound like a god, but I think anytime you put anything out into the world, you have to let go of it a bit in that mm-hmm. you never know how it's going to be received or, you know, what feedback you're going to get. So I have had to distance myself a little from it just because it is so intensely personal. But yeah, it is a little surreal too, because it took me 3.5 years to write. And the fact that it's like a physical object now or like a actual thing is still hard for me to fathom, because there were just so many moments of being like, I will not be able to finish this.
Well, I think it's also, I mean, it's such a personal book. It's also really in support of like the idea that we need to be better at making room for our more chaotic selves, you know, which is so much easier said than done.
I know. And it's hard to even, because it feels like often when we bring some of these conversations online or on social media, it's like they just inherently get flattened in a way that turns into like a soundbite or a meme or something. And it is, I think the point of my book is in some ways arguing that we can't flatten everything, because we're just more than like the digitally curated versions of ourselves, even the quote unquote messy ones. So I think it just bears witness to the fact that a lot of this unpacking has to be done, like, you know, with other people or just like with sources that we trust and feel like room to be maybe contradictory versions of ourselves or parts of ourselves that haven't fully figured out, you know, where we are at on certain things.
Yeah, I really love the like haven't figured out where we were fully at with thing, because I feel like this book is not like, here's a tidy bow, I put on all the messy parts of myself. You know, like you even have this phrase, it's really lovely, the fickle irresolution of life. Like, I think you really are acknowledging like, yes, I am in the process of unpacking, you know?
Yeah. And it's sort of to that point, an ongoing process. Like, I think I turned 40 last year, and I think I for me, that felt like the first moment the end was conceivably in sight, and kind of realizing that, oh, a lot of these things are probably never going to be fully figured out. And part of life is just being in that process and being okay with the fact that it is a process and there is no, you know, end besides the like finite end that we all get. And being okay with that, kind of being like, yeah, we're all kind of these weird Mobius strips that never quite like make sense. Like, we kind of get lost in our own path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's beautiful. I think it can be really frustrating at times, of course, too, but I think there's something really lovely about what you've come up with here, you know?
Oh, thank you. I mean, I, as someone who lives very much in my own head, it's like so nice to just hear anyone resonating with it, because I think that is part of the reason I like to write and put myself out into the world, is just to remember that other people are maybe having very similar experiences and I'm just not seeing it because I'm too lost in my own journey, and remembering that we're all kind of like at these different way stations in our own journeys and like finding where those intersect with each other.
Yeah, totally. I think one thing that really spoke to me in your book was the idea of like how difficult it can be to listen to your gut and to follow your intuition when you're also dealing with depression and anxiety, because it's like, you know, it's like, is this the weird brain telling me this stuff, or can I trust my gut with this?
I know. And knowing like what is a distorted version of your thought versus like the quote unquote good version or the healthier version. I mean, sometimes I have to make that distinction of, it's like, do I not want to go out because I'm depressed or because I need a night to recharge and stay in? And sometimes I like make the wrong call. And I think that's okay. We're all trying.
I think especially as an introvert, it can be really tough to like, is this recharging or is this wallowing?
Yeah. And I think society is quick to be like, it's wallowing, come on out, join the party, you know? And so, trying to make those distinctions between like, what is society being like, why don't you fit into this one cardboard cutout of what we want a person to be, versus like, where does my actual self fit into that?
Yeah, I can come to the party, but I will cry at the party.
Yeah, or I will cry after, or I will just, not be there in my head.
So you also talk a lot about like how deeply anxious you get before doing stand-up. And I would love to talk a little bit more, if you're up for it, about like why you still do it.
Yeah, I was talking to another comedian about this recently, and we were both like, yeah, I don't know how to answer that question sometimes, because it is one of those things where I do it and it provides a release and some sort of like small absolution in those certain performances where you just feel like you're in the zone and you're really connecting. But then there is also definitely a trade-off on the other side of just like, you know, feeling maybe overexposed or just like misunderstood in a way that is hard to capture because it's such a specific medium. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's like that high everyone talks about where you're just like always chasing it, but I think it does offer me some kind of catharsis in doing it that I find hard to access in other parts of my life.
Mm. I have said this on Nerd Out before, but one thing I sort of like half fantasize about is just like working at the post office.
Oh, and yeah.
Like having a chill ass 9 to 5 where I like, you know, spend some time outside, deliver mail. And then like once I clock out, I don't have to think about my job at all until I show up the next day again, you know, which is like, of course, never going to happen in journalism. What is there like a chill ass job like that that you daydream about now and then?
Oh, yeah. I think my go-to like backup fantasy is like moving to a small town and working at a bookstore, and I have to like not let myself get, you know, fill in too many more details after that, because then it will quickly be like, oh yeah, and then you'll go home and you'll be like, but what's the point of all of this, and like you'll still have the same brain, so you could never escape that. But yeah, like the idea of it is so idyllic to me, of just, yeah, like very like, I don't know, rom-com little bookstore, small town.
Mm. So I mean, you did a fair amount of reporting through this book. I'm curious if there was a particular takeaway that you found particularly surprising over the course of writing it.
Yeah. I mean, I that's so nice of you to call it reporting, because I tell people I wrote like basically a book of like journalism fan fiction, where it's just like I like the books of essays I love are all like, you know, your Gia Tolentinos and like your like actual reporter and like, you know, essay writers. And then I was just like, this is my version, you know, my like 50 Shades of Grey to their Twilight or whatever. So that's very kind of you to say, but yeah, I feel like in the end, I was just like really leaning into my undergraduate psych major, which is just like, oh, I like psychology because it's secretly just a way to study yourself.
Mm.
all the facts and figures were just in service of me further gazing into my navel.
I mean, I don't know, though. I still think people are going to get stuff out of it.
Yeah. I mean, look, my navel is a portal to your navel. You know, like everyone loves to find out more about themselves. And sometimes the best way to do that is through reading about other people, weirdly enough.
Aparna, thank you so much for coming on. This was a really delightful conversation.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you for having me. What a pleasure.
All right, that's it for this week. In case you missed it, I would like to highlight that we have a delightful interview with Lauren Groff in the feed about her newest book, The Vaster Wilds. That is our October book club selection. So take a listen to the spoiler-free interview, read the book, and then share your thoughts with us. You can record yourself on your smartphone and email the file over to nerdatpodcast@gmail.com. We love when you participate in book club. Also, just to give you a heads up so that you can participate, our November selection is Land of Milk and Honey by C. Pam Song. It is out in the world, so go get that one too and get reading. Nerdette is produced by me and Anna Bauman at WBEZ in Chicago and is part of the NPR network. And our executive producer is Brendan Banizak. We will see you next week.
Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.